objectively are an act of worship and profoundly associated with the struggle of Ibrahim alayhi salam, his son Ismail alayhi salam, and his wife Hajar. And if we were to remain heedless of these aspects while studying the secrets and objectives of Hajj, many of its rites and rituals would only float before us as enigmas. For example, when we bring to mind the struggle of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, the champion of monotheism against the whisperings of the Satan, who appeared before him on three occasions, each time seeking to weaken his resolve and distract him from the Jihad al-Akbar. And on each occasion, Ibrahim alayhi salam repelled him by means of stones. These rites appear more meaningful and comprehensible to us. Imam Khamenei Hafizullah Sirrah also says in that regard, the Hajj embodies the essential elements that are necessary for this individual and social moral education. You know, we should know that all Hajj rituals serve as a means for moral education and admonition. The individual relationship of each heart with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala while being among a large number of other praying hearts, the presence in Mina and stoning the icons that symbolize Satan, the significant act of sacrificing and feeding the poor and the passers-by. You know, all of these are important life lessons for us. And just like what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, we must make use of these lessons to improve our spirituality and divine views as well. Thank you very much for being with us in this episode of Spring of the Truth. Until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. It is said King Nasreddin Shah Qajar stayed 3 days in Semnan on his way to Mashhad. There was a building at the time that had 12 different towers and a southern gate, but no gate on the north side. During his short stay in Semnan, Nasreddin Shah ordered the ruler of the city to build the northern gate for the Arg or the citadel. And it means I'm going to Semnan province today. The Semnan Arg Gate is located in Semnan province, north-central Iran. This gate is one of Semnan's most famous attractions that has become a symbol of this city and has spectacular engravings and illustrations. Built during the Qajar dynasty, this structure is above 7 meters high. Its decoration is so beautiful that it catches everyone's attention. This gate is the only remain of the old Arch of Semnan, and its glory shows the old Arch well. The complex used to consist of buildings such as a telegraph room, a water cistern, a bathroom, and so on. This gate has been registered in Iran's National Heritage List. Okay, right now I'm across from the famous gate of Semnan, the Semnan Arg Gate. Wow, it's unique. Where on earth can you find such a beautiful gate? It's interesting to note that Arg used to be an administrative center in the past, and this gate is just a small part of the old Arg of Semnan, which no longer exists. Let me take a closer look at this magnificent gate. Wow, it's very tall. And it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes, it has 6 minarets, which are built symmetrically. Oh, look. I think that is the most prominent feature of the portal. It depicts the historical story of Rostam and White Demon on 7 color tiles. Other tile decorations include the illustrations of Qajarid soldiers. And on the walls, there are tile work inscriptions written in the beautiful Nastaliq style of calligraphy. Astonishing! Thank you. Let me check the southern part of the gate. In the southern part, there are two rooms which are built symmetrically, which are overlooking two Ivans. There are two small corridors along with the main entrance that used to be a place for entering and exiting. Although the northern part of the gate is much more distinguished than the southern gate, overall, this structure is a very, very special gate I've ever seen in whole of my life. And let me add one thing. The doors. They're made of thick wood, which are decorated with beautiful door studs. And be careful. Just like the past, the door will be closed after the sunset.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what is one of the ways of being able to control ourselves in our Islamic lifestyle? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is a pleasure to be here at your service, dear friends. We are talking about what is one of the things that we can do in order to fight ourselves in this struggle against the nafs when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Now, as many of you know, a part and parcel of a Islamic lifestyle is to be able to attain perfection and to attain what is known as this kamal, this perfection, this magnificence that comes about when one attains higher levels of purification, both spiritual and physical. So in order to attain that kind of a Islamic lifestyle where, you know, we attain both physical and spiritual purification, of course, we are going to have to struggle against our base desires. Now, these base desires are manifested in worldliness. It is manifested in these kind of temporary worldly pleasures. Many books have been written about this, and so it is highly encouraged that one goes and reads these books that deal with this kind of, you know, ethical and moral, which is known as akhlaq in the Arabic. And these books on akhlaq are really very precious and necessary if we want to live a Islamic lifestyle. So what is one of the things that we can do in order to struggle against our base desires, our carnal desires, this insatiable greed for worldly pleasures? Well, it's interesting, the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, gives us two things that we can do, which we will talk about after the break. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we were talking about the two things that we can do in order to be able to fight and struggle against ourselves, our carnal self, which pushes one towards an insatiable greed for worldly pleasures and worldly material things. Now, as we have said in previous programs, there's nothing wrong with using and taking advantage of and benefiting from these worldly things in a balanced manner. It is when they go out of balance and out of control that we start to go towards trouble. Now, the two things that the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, and his holy household has taught us, which will help us to be able to control ourselves, is to reduce the amount of food and drink that we intake. And in return, if we reduce the amount of food and drink that we intake, the angels will come and protect us, and Shaitan, the accursed enemy of humanity, will flee from us. He will run away from us. And so it's very interesting here. We find that overindulgence in food and drink will therefore have the opposite results, meaning that Shaitan will come towards us and the angels won't protect us as much as when we reduce the amount of food and drink that we intake. Now, of course, this is done with the intention to gain nearness to the Almighty Allah. And of course, this is a gradual reduction in food and drink. It's interesting, in other traditions we find that, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said to only eat when you are hungry and to only drink when you are thirsty. Now, of course, you know, we need to keep certain medical principles in line. We're not asking anybody to starve to death or to die of thirst. No, this means that we should not overindulge in these things. And if we are able to reduce the amount of food and drink that we are intaking, then it will make it just a little bit easier to be able to struggle against the self and attain a higher level of spirituality and purification, which will lead, of course, to that pure and blessed Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Two-thirds being in the affirmative, the rules are suspended. The bill is passed, and without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
A U.S. government shutdown narrowly averted. This extension was more of a band-aid, since there's a strong possibility that lawmakers will find themselves battling it out in 45 days when the deadline arrives. However, what things the U.S. government spends its money on has been overlooked, which ironically should be the focus. Just take a look at these eye-popping figures. If there was a shutdown, soldiers would not get paid, and the ones on the bottom half of the social strata, especially ones getting government assistance and social services, would suffer. The government has averted a shutdown, but what about the wider U.S. economy? News making headlines in the U.S. are the auto workers' strike, which has expanded for the first time ever to include the Detroit Three. The union and the automakers remain far apart on key economic issues like pay.
We're not out here to grab headlines. You know, this isn't fun to us. We're not out here just for the heck of it. We're out here because GM and the three companies screwed around for over 7 weeks and didn't get into bargaining with us.
The fact of the matter is that you guys, the UAW, you saved the automobile industry back in 2008 and before. Made a lot of sacrifices.
But the automakers did not reciprocate. Since 2013, they have raked in $250 billion in profits. That's $1.7 million that they made off each worker. Meanwhile, these are their CEOs' salaries. Ford CEO Jim Farley, a modest $21 million per year. Stellantis CEO Carlos Tavares, $25 million per year. And General Motors CEO Mary Barra, who said she was extremely frustrated and disappointed by the strike, she makes $29 million per year. One automaker summed it up perfectly. I think people all around the country here are just getting fed up with the corporations not sharing or including them into the profit or acknowledging our hard work that we put into the company. The stats confirm that sentiment. Between 1979 and 2022, the inflation-adjusted annual wages of the top 1% of workers rose by 145%, while the average annual wages of the bottom 90% rose by only 16%. In the U.S., while the number of strikes is relatively unchanged, the number of striking workers has beat prior years.
No more tears!
Some 362,000 workers have gone on a strike so far in 2023, compared with 36,600 over the same period 2 years ago. Job security should be a concern for Americans. Corporate bankruptcies have soared to a 13-year high. The workers on strike, like many other Americans, complain that their wages have not kept up with inflation. The official inflation rate in the U.S. for 2023 reported to be 3%, with the pay increase to have been 5%, outstripping inflation. But that does not match what the average American is facing when it comes to things like groceries, energy, transportation, travel, and dining. Just take a look at these figures in this table, showing the types of inflation that Americans faced in 2022. Although inflation has decreased in 2023, it is not the 5% that the U.S. government has announced across the board. Perhaps that is why the U.S. is experiencing an increase in poverty, which in 2022 was 12.4%. That's an increase of 4.6 percentage points from 2021. And in terms of food assistance, another shocking figure, 41.2 million Americans, 12.5% of the total U.S. population, received monthly SNAP benefits in the 2022 fiscal year. The U.S. makes around $6.3 trillion in income, and believe it or not, spends half of that amount on entitlement programs like food assistance and benefits. This does not sound like a very healthy economy. A new study has shown that Britain's cost of living crisis that mainly results from the government's economic policy is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. The results of the research were published by the BMJ Public Health Journal. The study showed that the cost of living crisis and sustained period of high prices will reduce life expectancy among the people across the country by 6.5% this year. The predicted increase in premature deaths from a baseline of 463 per 100,000 people to 493 per 100,000 equates to thousands of extra deaths a year in the UK. The study says that the most deprived households will experience four times the number of extra deaths than the wealthiest households, with the poorest having to spend a large proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared. Evidence shows low income is associated with poorer health, and that falls in income adversely affect health. According to last month's figures, the UK's inflation stood at 6.7%.
For me, this whole conversation is about whether I heat the house or whether I breathe. And it so hard to describe what actions are in real terms, because it's an immediate threat to your life.
Although it was down from a high of 11.1%, Britain's inflation still remains the highest among the member states of the Group of Seven. Meanwhile, there are gloomy predictions about UK's economic prospects. A report by the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics says that the UK economy will shrink this year and in 2024. It says a drop in GDP this year of 0.3% would be followed by a fall of 0.2% next year.
Now, if we look at the data that we've seen recently, obviously there can be some revisions in the GDP data. We saw quite a contraction in July. Now, we are expecting, perhaps there are some quirks in the data that we haven't seen as much industrial action recently, and there could be some technical issues and a rebound. But I think the outlook for the rest of this year is quite weak. And we see that, as you've mentioned, in the PMI surveys, both manufacturing and services moving into contraction.
There are fears that the UK is suffering from structural economic conditions. Factors related to the underlying weakness of the UK economy and the fallout from Brexit will leave the UK behind, while most other developed economies expand. The UK was also suffering from an unequal recovery that benefited better-off households, while the bottom half of the income scale continued to be affected by falling real incomes. Persistent inflation, falling real incomes of low-income households, and a shortage of workers will result in the drop in the country's gross domestic product. Cuts to government spending next year will also drag on economic growth. The central bank held rates at 5.25% at its meeting, and betting on financial markets showed investors expect there will be no change at the next meeting in November. The next move could be upwards should inflation prove to be more stubborn than the central bank's forecasts predict, despite a weakening of economic growth.
I think really what we're seeing is they are worried about the recession. They are worried about weaker growth, and they think that perhaps going into the rest of this year, inflation is likely to continue to decelerate. So what we're seeing is the lagged impact of fairly aggressive monetary tightening really starting to bite. And they're probably thinking, right, that here is a time to pause, but we don't want to get too complacent. There are still a lot of inflationary pressures ahead.
The economic crisis and persistent inflation has caused trouble for the ruling Tories in the UK. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's popularity has fallen to its lowest levels ever. Some 68% of Britons currently have an unfavorable view of the Prime Minister, the highest figure since becoming Prime Minister, while only 23% have a favorable view.
The truth is, the floor fell in for millions of families because of their economic mayhem. Yep. The classroom ceilings collapsed because he cut vital school budgets. Yep. And now the walls of our national security have been breached because they've ignored repeated warnings. No one voted for these shambles. No one voted for him. So how much more damage do the British public have to put up with before he finally finds the stomach to give them a say?
Iran has vowed a resolute response to Israel after the regime's prime minister threatened to use nuclear weapons against the Islamic Republic. Amir Saeed Iravani said Israel's threat to use nuclear weapons is a serious threat to international peace and security, and the international community must not remain indifferent or silent. The Iranian envoy urged the United Nations Security Council to denounce Israel's reckless statement. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations has also denounced Israel's nuclear threat against the country. Zahra Ershadi has called on the international community to force the regime to abandon nuclear weapons, join the NPT, and accept the IAEA safeguard system.
The Israeli regime, with the support of the United States, has consistently opposed all initiatives aimed at establishing a nuclear weapon-free zone in the Middle East. The possession of hundreds of nuclear weapons by this regime poses a severe threat to the security of the Middle East and beyond. A vivid example of this regime's outlawed action is calling for a so-called, I quote, credible nuclear threat against Iran, end of quote, which was brazenly raised by the regime's prime minister on 22nd September 2023.
Ershadi slammed Tel Aviv's irresponsible threat, which he said was against international norms and rules. Days earlier, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had addressed the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly, calling for a credible nuclear threat against Iran.
Sanctions must be snapped back. And above all, Iran must face a credible nuclear threat.
His office soon afterwards said that Netanyahu had misspoken and that his prepared text said credible military threat. Iran says the international community should reject and condemn any normalization of nuclear rhetoric and, in particular, the threat of use of nuclear weapons. Israel has a widely known but undeclared nuclear program. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, as of January, Israel was believed to possess a stockpile of around 90 nuclear warheads. But analysts believe the regime possesses 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal, making it the Middle East's sole possessor of non-conventional arms. The Tel Aviv regime has, however, refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. On the contrary, Iran has long been cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, as a signatory to the NPT. Tehran has repeatedly declared that its nuclear program remains purely peaceful as always, and that the Islamic Republic had no intention of developing nuclear weapons as a matter of Islamic and state principles. Iran proved the peaceful nature of its nuclear program to the world by signing the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, with six world powers, but the United States later quit it. Ever since the Islamic Republic of Iran decided to restart its nuclear activities after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, it has faced consistent threats from Western nations and their regional allies, especially Israel. The Tel Aviv regime has launched sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinated its nuclear scientists. Several Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2020. Israel has pressed upon its allies that Iran's program is malicious, partly as a smokescreen for its own nuclear program and its scores of undeclared nuclear warheads.
What I call in English whistleblower, to inform the world about Israel's nuclear secret, because no one speak or no one report exactly what's going there.
In 1986, Vanunu duped Israel's vaunted security apparatus and smuggled a camera into the secret Dimona plant. His photographs exposed the world's greatest nuclear cover-up. What he showed was that Israel's nuclear arms program was far bigger and much more powerful than anyone had even dreamt possible.
Enough material every year for 10 bombs.
Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has campaigned against Iran for almost 30 years. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities.
The U.S. President Joe Biden went on a three-day trip to Asia recently. His trip included stops in India for the G20 summit, then Vietnam, to upgrade their bilateral relationship. The purpose of his trip was to enhance U.S. relationship with regional countries, especially in a G20 format. But that is just a formal way of not saying what the true intentions of the U.S. president were. For starters, Joe Biden had said that his intentions to strengthen ties with China's neighbors weren't designed to contain Beijing, a phrase that he has repeated again and again. He has said things like, "I don't want to contain China. We're not trying to hurt China. America's goal is getting the relationship right."
I am sincere about getting the relationship right. And one of the things that is going on now is China's beginning to change some of the rules of the game.
But his visit to Vietnam right after the G20 summit relayed a different message. The two countries signed a historic agreement to upgrade relations to the level of comprehensive strategic partnership. Joe Biden secured deals with Vietnam on semiconductors and minerals. So important is Vietnam for the U.S. that executives from Google, Intel, Amcor, Marvel, Global Foundries, and Boeing met with Vietnamese tech executives, along with the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, for more deals with semiconductors, the centerpiece of an action plan adopted during Biden's visit. So what gives? Why is Vietnam so important to the U.S.? It's pretty obvious. The U.S. wants to rival China and at the same time inflict economic damage. So much for Biden saying we're not trying to hurt China. But the U.S. has other plans for Vietnam, which was not announced yet. After the U.S. and Vietnam elevated their relationship to comprehensive strategic partnership, there were reports that the U.S. and Vietnam were negotiating a major arms deal, perhaps the biggest in their history, one that would involve F-16 fighter jets. Here are some interesting facts behind U.S.-Vietnam military relationship. Since an arms embargo was lifted in 2016, U.S. arms exports to Vietnam were limited to just Coast Guard ships and trainer aircraft. So, from Coast Guard ships and trainer aircraft to F-16 fighter jets? What gives? By the way, Russia has supplied about 80% of Vietnam's military arsenal. Yet Vietnam is just one of many countries that the U.S. has been selling military equipment to in the Asia-Pacific region. Here is one snapshot. Osprey aircraft to Indonesia for $2 billion. $2 billion in missiles and upgrades to Taiwan. $30 billion to South Korea. $2 billion in attack helicopters, as well as support boats to the Philippines. And $23.11 billion to Japan for 105 F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft and related equipment. No wonder China is angered. The U.S. actions do not match its rhetoric when it comes to China. It is clear that it wants to militarize the region, very similar to how it did with NATO countries in Europe, the target there being Russia. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman urged Washington to abandon its Cold War mentality and to refrain from provoking an arms race in Asia.
China hopes that when developing bilateral relations and conducting military cooperation, relevant countries will effectively abide by the basic norms of international relations, abandon hegemony and Cold War thinking, stop provoking confrontation and stimulating arms races.
But that has fallen on U.S.'s deaf ears. The U.S. has gone all out to align regional countries with it. Up on issues like Taiwan, North Korea, and the disputed islands are cards that the U.S. plays to its favor to do that. But the region will soon turn into a tinderbox if it hasn't already, and it would only take one spark, like the Taiwan issue or North Korea, for it to explode.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps Aerospace Force has successfully put the Nur-3 satellite into orbit. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, Aerospace Force, successfully launched the homegrown imaging satellite Nur 3 into orbit recently. Nur 3, meaning Light 3, was launched by satellite carrier Qased Messenger and was placed into an orbit 450 kilometers above the Earth's surface. Minister of Communications and Information Technology Isa Zarepour said via X, formerly known as Twitter, "With the efforts of IRGC Aerospace Force specialist, a few moments ago, the Nur 3 imaging satellite was successfully placed into a 450 kilometers orbit of the Earth with the Iranian Qased satellite carrier. I congratulate all Iranian people, those active in the country's space industry, and the IRGC's space experts for this success. God willing, this year will be a fruitful year for the country's space industry." Last month, Iranian Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani announced that the country would launch at least two domestically made satellites into orbit this year. Ashtiani said on August 22nd, "We are involved in the development and launch of satellites. Under our plan, we will have 2 to 3 satellite launches this year, something we hope to be successful." Despite sanctions imposed by Western countries in recent years, Iran has managed to take giant strides in the civilian space program. It is among the world's top 10 countries capable of developing and launching satellites. Back in March last year, the IRGC Aerospace Force launched Nur 2 into orbit using the Qased satellite carrier 2 years after it placed Nur 1 into orbit. Meanwhile, Tasnim News Agency wrote, "The President of Iran hailed the successful launch of the Nur 3 satellite into orbit as both a national victory and proof that the enemy's sanctions and threats have ended in failure." In a message recently, Sayed Ebrahim Raisi offered his congratulations to the Iranian nation and space experts of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, on the successful production and launch of the Nur 3 imaging satellite and thanked all those who played a role in this achievement. He said the launch was a national success and the result of his administration's attention to the country's space industry. "It once again proved that the enemy's sanctions and threats have no impact on the determination of Iranian experts and scientists to tread the path of progress." The Iranian president also called on the Ministry of Telecommunications and Information Technology, as well as the Iranian Space Agency, to continue to pave the way for further progress of the country's space industry. The IRGC Aerospace Force successfully launched the homegrown imaging satellite Nur 3 into orbit. Recently, Nur 3 was launched by satellite carrier and was placed into orbit 450 kilometers above the Earth's surface. Despite sanctions imposed by Western countries in recent years, Iran has managed to take giant strides in the civilian space program. It is among the world's top 10 countries capable of developing and launching satellites. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera English wrote in this regard, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps has successfully put a third satellite into orbit, according to officials. Two officials confirmed recently that the Aerospace Division of the Elite Military Force has put the third version of the imaging satellite Nur, which means light in Persian, into orbit. The Nur 3 was reportedly placed in an orbit 450 kilometers from the surface of the Earth and, like its predecessors, was taken to space using a Qasid, meaning messenger carrier developed by the IRGC. Al Jazeera English added, Western officials did not immediately comment on the launch recently. The first version of the Nur was successfully launched in April 2020 into an orbit 425 kilometers above the Earth. It became the first military reconnaissance satellite launched by Iran after several attempts. The second version reached an orbit of 500 kilometers in early 2022 using the mixed fuel carrier. Despite criticism from the West, Iranian officials have promised to carry on with the expanding satellite program and are expected to launch several more satellites into different orbits in the foreseeable future. In August 2022, an Iranian-owned and Russian-built satellite said to be capable of taking high-resolution images was successfully launched from a base in Kazakhstan. Al Jazeera English continued, Western countries have claimed the development of Iranian satellites may violate a United Nations Security Council resolution underpinning the country's 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. Iran has repeatedly dismissed such claims, maintaining that its nuclear program is entirely peaceful. The nuclear deal, formally known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, continues to be in limbo after the United States unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed harsh sanctions on Iran. Iranian officials have recently suggested again that they are open to returning to the accord, but would first need to see political resolve from the Western parties, which also include France, Germany, and the UK.
The reality of Amazon.
Part 1.
If you observe the Earth from the space, you may not find all natural features that you studied in geography books, such as mountains, lakes, rivers, plains, etc. They don't look like the same as you imagined. You can't see the Mount Everest from that large distance, but there are features that can be seen easily from the space, like the Amazon River. The Amazon River is approximately 6,500 to 6,800 kilometers long and has an average discharge of about 215,000 to 230,000 cubed per second. The Amazon River sets the record in terms of the sheer volume of water. It is the largest rainforest ecosystem in the world. The jungles surrounding the Amazon River are considered the lungs of the planet. It is home to numerous different species. There are thousands of distinct creatures in the Amazon, and you can find everything there. there is also a large company that has been active for 25 years in Seattle, US, where you can find everything you need except houses, cars, cigarettes, and predatory animals. These are actually Jeff Bezos' red lines. He's the founder and CEO of Amazon, who had big dreams since he was a primary school student. He's one of the richest men in the world. In the 70s, when he was a primary school student, he wrote an essay and mentioned his dreams. Bezos stressed that Earth is the most precious planet and thought about moving off this planet. He thought of a gigantic ship that could be home to people. In that time, Bezos just wrote his dreams, but now he thinks seriously about that project. Jeff Bezos unveils his grand space plans in his conferences. He talks about his plan for colonizing the space. According to many, this plan is not practical and seems funny to them. It is as funny as one person became the richest person on Earth by selling his books. Jeff Bezos did the same thing and now owns the largest retail store in the world. In the beginning, he just sold books and nothing else. For many decades, bookstores did not pay attention to technological advances and the fundamental changes, and only used to sell books. They dealt with the return of the books and small sizes of the warehouses. People were also used to buy books in large cities. Bezos graduated from Princeton University in 1986 with degrees in electrical engineering and computer science. He worked on Wall Street in a variety of related fields afterwards. Then he thought about selling books online. He later said in an interview that when he realized in 1994 that the use of the internet had grown 23 times compared to the previous year, it was a better idea to invest in this industry. Most of the people didn't see this type of data useful at all. 2 years later, he sold the first book online.
We all know that a communications revolution is underway in this country.
What is the internet?
It's sort of the mother of all networks.
It's information highways.
It's kind of like your remote control to the world.
I came across the startling statistic that web usage was growing at 2,300% a year. So I decided I would try and find a business plan that made sense in the context of that growth. And I picked books as the first best product to sell online.
Soon, publishers and libraries welcomed Amazon's activities and started to sell and buy books online. Then, Amazon revenue increased day by day. In 1996, Amazon grew its revenue to $16 million. This company was founded with an investment of $300,000 by Jeff Bezos' Cuban stepfather. Net sales for fiscal 1997 were $147.8 million, an 838% increase over net sales of $15.7 million reported for fiscal 1996. This year, Amazon's book warehouses were the size of 6 football fields. At that time, people realized that a giant had stepped into the world of information technology. Jeff Bezos used a very simple method to earn money. He found an easy way to sell books. He owned large book warehouses. Amazon started to ask for small discounts from publishers to have the books and then sell them online. It didn't matter to Bezos where you lived. Wherever a person had access to the internet, there was a branch of Amazon and the book would reach him in the shortest possible time. Customers used to buy these books cheaper than other stores. the number of Amazon users increased for the same reason. Amazon served over 17 million customer accounts. Customers also used to buy DVDs and musical instruments as well. In fact, Bezos used the book as a drug. People in all around the world were addicted to Amazon and its books, and Bezos tried to come up with new items in his company. He used to tell his employees that this is just the beginning. In the beginning of the 21st century, Bezos began selling more products on Amazon. Amazon started to suggest new products to customers every time. Considering all these products, books were the most important products for people in that time. Amazon's revenue reached more than $2.7 billion of the new century. For Amazon's revenue exceeded $3 billion. There were more than billion. Amazon moved its warehouses to other cities around the world. In this way, customers received their products in the shortest time.
Amazon could soon become the Walmart of the internet.
There were thousands of businesses eager to sell online. Bezos offered them a way to do it.
Amazon is transforming itself from an online bookstore to an online mall.
He transformed Amazon into a retail platform where anyone could sell their goods to his customers, and invited thousands of other businesses to be a part of it.
It's the easiest place for anybody, small or large, who wants to set up shop online to sell online, because they can access our 12 million plus customers. Anybody, all comers.
In 2003, Amazon launched Search Inside the Book. Users were allowed to search for the desired term in a book without purchasing it. Publishers cautiously agreed that Amazon would scan some books and turn them into searchable text. In fact, Bezos was promoting the digital book industry at that time. In that time, Apple controlled the music market with iPad and iTunes, and Bezos didn't want to lose his control over the book market.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran stresses opposition to any geopolitical change in the Caucasus region, but welcomes the expansion of transit routes. Anti-war activist